Hello, I'm Sean Seymour, London Walks Guide. And today, the 9th of April, we learnt that Prince Philip, the consort of the Queen, has died. Well, I was born in 1949, so Prince Philip had been married to the Queen since 47. But of course, as a child brought up in middle-class Britain, he was a commanding national figure. Later on, we would read the gossip columns and hear the reaction of the establishment over his salty comments about British incompetence and laziness. His early campaigns for the World Wildlife Fund were groundbreaking in the 60s and 70s, drawing attention to endangered species and also harm to the environment. He did try to modernise the royal profile, though in retrospect the 1969 film The Royal Family was, I think, a mistake. You have to keep the mystery and not reveal too much about what is almost a mythical construct. I met him briefly at the Britain Visitor Centre along with Mary and Tom, two London Walks guides. He was quite animated and chatty, looking at our badges. Her Majesty was rather on autopilot and probably dying for a coffee. And despite the formality of his position, he was an independent spirit, his own man, and of course had a very successful naval career in World War II. And I thought in tribute to that I'd sing you a verse from Hearts of Oak, a naval song written in 1759. Come cheer up, my lads, 'tis to glory we steer, to add something more to this wonderful year. To honour we call you, not press you like slaves, so who are so free as the sons of the waves? Hearts of oak are our ships, jolly tars are our men, we always are ready. Steady, boys, steady. We'll fight and we'll conquer again and again. Bom, bom, bom.
Over the years, I've been involved in many of the royal-themed walks at London Walks, from the royal wedding walk that we did in 2011 when Prince William married his sweet Kate, to much more recently, a series of walks based on The Crown, the Netflix series, looking not only at some of the film locations, but delving into the characters of the royal family. It's a fascinating subject. And always Prince Philip was a constant and quite a sort of a challenging character at times as well. But when I heard about his passing today, there's one thing that came to the surface for me that struck me. And it struck me that, of course, Prince Philip always called the Queen Cabbage. It was his pet name for her. And you can just imagine him saying it, kind of, come along, Cabbage. Don't worry, Cabbage, old thing. You can just imagine him saying it. And I think it speaks volumes for perhaps their life behind closed doors, their private relationship. There's a jollity, there's a certain good humour there that would have been a wonderful antidote to all that pomp and circumstance and serious formality. And so today, when I heard that Prince Philip had died, I thought, who's going to call the Queen Cabbage now?
Hello, my name's Brian Hicks, and I've been asked to say a few words about Prince Philip, who unfortunately has just died. Prince Philip and I share a birthday. He was born on June the 10th in 1921, and I was born somewhat later than that. He is regarded, or was regarded, by some members of the inner circle as being a bit of an outsider when he was being debated as a member of the royal family by marrying the then Princess Elizabeth. The reason for that is because his links, although he was Prince Philip of Greece, born on a kitchen table in Corfu in 1921, his family's connections are to the Danish royal house, to the House of Hesse, and to the Russian royal family. That's one of the reasons why, when they were doing DNA tests on the bodies of the assassinated Russian royal family, they asked Prince Philip for a sample of his DNA, because he is very closely related to the Russian royal family. In the case of Prince Philip, he served in the Royal Navy. My father served under him and said that he was a diligent and a strict commander, which you can see that he would have been actually very good. He put his naval career behind him when his wife ascended to the throne on February the 6th in 1952. He pursued his own path. He set up the Duke of Edinburgh scheme. He was involved in architecture. He was involved in the World Wildlife Fund, and he was involved in charity. And that's where many of the royal family, particularly the younger ones, William and Harry, and also, of course, Prince Charles, have got their sort of social responsibility from. A lot of this has come from Prince Charles. Prince Philip. In the case of Prince Philip, he had the occasional gaffe. We won't dwell on those now, because I think those gaffes pale into insignificance in comparison, actually, to his achievements, which were so great. But his greatest achievement of all, in the case of Prince Philip, was his support of the Queen. She referred to him, actually, in that speech down at the banqueting house, as being her rock. He was always there. He was always standing behind her. I'm sure he was always there as an advisor, actually, to the Queen. And that's how he's going to be remembered, as the great supporter, actually, of Her Majesty the Queen. And I'm sure she will be devastated, as other members of the royal family will be, at his death, at the great age of 99.
I always admired Prince Philip because he spent his entire life brilliantly balanced on a knife edge between being his own man, being no patsy, no fool, not afraid to speak his mind, but also being in devoted service to his wife, to the Queen, and to the country. He did it brilliantly. And evidence of how adept he was at maintaining that perfect balance is now seen today in the outpouring of grief and, most importantly, I think, respect from the nation.
Hello everyone, this is Simon Whitehouse, London Walks Guide, and today we are paying tribute to the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, who has passed away on the 9th of April 2021, aged 99 years old. I'm one of a small team of guides for London Walks who conducts a walk called The Crown, and the walk is based on the TV series of the same name, the Netflix series, and we cover all of the key royal and political locations in the heart of the city of Westminster. And we try and tell the story of The Crown, separating the fact from the fiction. And we've been asked today to provide our own stories regarding the Duke of Edinburgh. Now, one story that springs to mind for me especially, due to the fact that both my parents happen to be deaf and are users of British Sign Language, is a story which is indeed verifiable, one of the many stories concerning the Duke of Edinburgh with regard to his gift for what he described as dontopedology, which is the art of putting one's foot in one's mouth. And what happened is that in 1999, the Duke of Edinburgh was attending a celebration of the opening of the Welsh Assembly in the grounds of Cardiff Castle in Wales. And there was a group of young deaf people who were present, and they were members of the Cardiff BDA, which is the British Deaf Association. And the leader of the group seemingly approached the Duke of Edinburgh and asked if he would like to meet and shake hands with this group of deaf youngsters. Very close by was a steel band who were playing very loud Caribbean music. And the Duke is alleged to have said to the group leader, "Deaf, if you're near there, no wonder you're deaf." Now, understandably, the British Deaf Association were somewhat offended by this, because the Duke of Edinburgh was perhaps inferring that the youngsters were deaf on, or had become deaf or deafened as a result of listening to loud music. And it was said that he showed a lack of understanding regarding deaf issues. And whilst undoubtedly the Duke of Edinburgh was guilty of putting his foot in his mouth on quite a number of occasions, and undoubtedly caused offence to all kinds of different people at different times, personally, I'm not sure that the Duke of Edinburgh intended to give offence to deaf people on that occasion. Now, I'm not a deaf person, and it would be interesting to ask a deaf person what they thought of that now. But the reason I don't think he was intentionally being hurtful was because actually he did have an understanding of deaf issues. And what people perhaps don't realise is that the Duke of Edinburgh's mother, Princess Alice of Battenberg, who was a great-granddaughter of Queen Victoria, was in fact deaf herself. She was congenitally deaf from birth, although she did speak fully. She spoke clearly. So I don't think he intended to be hurtful. And I think the Duke of Edinburgh was quoted later as having said that he was also the patron of another deaf charity. In fact, he was patron to, I think, about 800 charities in total, the Royal National Institute for the Deaf. So it would seem unlikely that he'd intended to be so. So I just thought I would share that story because it resonated with me personally. And whilst, as I said, I think the Duke of Edinburgh probably did make lots of gaffes, and some of them perhaps were intentional. I suspect most of them weren't intentional. I don't think he was being hurtful on that occasion. But it just led me to thinking about a wider story that, in fact, you know, over the centuries, you know, there have been several instances of members of the royal family being deaf. The one that really springs to mind, apart from Prince Philip's mother, Princess Alice, who did, in fact, eventually come to London and live in Buckingham Palace between 1967 and 1969, which is a story that I tell on The Crown Walk, but also Princess Alexandra, who was the Queen Consort to King Edward VII, Queen Victoria's eldest son. She was Danish, a great beauty, but again, deaf. And we understand that when she visited Queen Victoria, that she taught Queen Victoria how to fingerspell. And in fact was a great patron, we understand, of deaf artists, deaf sculptors. She supported deaf people wherever she could. So I think it's quite interesting, perhaps not a well-known story, about the links with members of the royal family and the deaf community. So anyway, that's my story that I wanted to share. And as I said, we are remembering today the passing of the Duke of Edinburgh.
Hi, this is Jan here. On hearing the news this morning, I started to reflect on what I knew of Prince Philip. And like many guides in London, I have seen him on a number of occasions through a car window as it sped past, usually at high speed, and at a distance in a carriage. However, around 7 years ago, while guiding at the Globe Theatre, word went around that Prince Philip was actually in the building. He had come to officially open the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse. And there was no fuss, no obvious security. After the official ceremony had finished, and of course I had not been invited, I and a few of my fellow colleagues decided to go to the front of the building to see him off. And apart from a few of us from the Globe and a few staff from Starbucks and the pizza restaurant opposite, it was very quiet. And the few tourists who were around didn't seem to notice as a very sprightly, elderly man bounced out, waving and smiling to us, and more than happy to pause and wave for a photo. Given that the recent news reports had been implying that now in his early 90s, as he was then, he was not in good health and planning on stepping back from his duties, this didn't really equate with what we were seeing, and he certainly seemed full of life. It was a further 2 or 3 years before he did actually step back from his royal duties. Despite often being ridiculed for making inappropriate and sometimes offensive remarks, he did actually have an incredibly busy work schedule and put all of the younger royals to shame with his stamina.
Hello everyone. My name is Deleanne Forget and I'm a London Walks guide and a professional actor. The story about Prince Philip that I'd like to share with you comes from my late husband Harry, who was the defence correspondent for the Sunday Telegraph. Around 1980, Harry had been sent up north to the christening of a new warship. Prince Philip was doing the honours, and Harry arrived late. He parked his car in a pub parking lot, as was his wont. Very handy for afterwards, because he did love his real ales. He was scuttling up the high street towards the shipyard gates when he stopped in his tracks, because there in an antique shop window, in pride of place, was a beautiful iron three-legged cauldron. Now, what a lot of people did not know about Harry at the time was the fact that, as well as being an esteemed journalist, he was the high priest of a pagan Wiccan coven. And this cauldron was the perfect witch's cauldron, and Harry had to have it. He'd been looking for one for a long time. He went into the shop and the purchase was made. Now, Harry was hoping to leave the cauldron behind and pick it up later, but the proprietor informed him that, alas, he was closing. There was nothing for it. Harry had to take the cauldron with him. Being late, Harry assumed that he would be ushered to the back of the press scrum, where it would be easy to hide the cauldron. But this was not to be. Coming from the Sunday Telegraph, Harry was ushered right to the front of the pack. And there he stood in the front row. Grey hair, grey beard, Gives and Hawks' immaculately tailored tweed suit, polished brogues, between which nestled his new purchase. Prince Philip arrives with his entourage, scowling at the line of press. The reporters were calling out the usual questions about, what do you think about the ship, sir? Will it increase Britain's war capabilities? Do you think we'll have to use it soon? And Prince Philip pauses. Something caught his attention. He leaves his entourage, takes three steps back, and comes to a pause in front of Harry. What the hell is that? Says the prince, pointing between Harry's shoes. It's a cauldron, sir, says Harry. Well, I can see that, says Prince Philip. What are you going to do with it, hey? Conjure up spirits? Harry decided to brazen it out. Well, yes, sir, that's exactly what I intend to do with it. Huh, says Philip, rocking back on his heels. Do you believe in all of that? You know, spirits, ghosts, that sort of thing? Yes, sir, replies my husband. Yes, actually, I do. Says Philip, thoughtfully. He gives the cauldron a gentle tap with the toe of the royal boot, and then swings on his heel and goes back to his entourage, where he pauses, turns back towards Harry, and gives him a conspiratorial wink. Years later, long after he'd retired from the Telegraph, Harry was invited to a luncheon at Buckingham Palace. He had been invited there because of his work with the WWF, and because of his writing about the countryside matters, which was much in the news at the time. It was about the mid-1990s. Harry arrives, and it's the pre-lunch drink occasion, and he's standing there with his whiskey in his hand. And Prince Philip enters, looks around the room, spots Harry, makes a beeline for him. When he reaches my husband, he leans over and whispers, "What about that damned cauldron, hey? Did you conjure up any interesting spirits with it?" Harry looked at him with a smile and replied, "No, sir, but I did conjure up a rather interesting wife." "Ah," says Philip, "well, that's a nice development." "Yes," says Harry, "she's Canadian." "Canadian," says Philip. "Ah, I like Canadians." The funny thing is, I have that cauldron still here. I'm looking at it right now as I'm talking to you, feeling Harry's spirit very much with me.
Okay, it's David here. I'm going to sort of get in on this act because I've been to Buckingham Palace and
met the Queen, and Prince Philip was there at the same time, but they were very efficient. Some of us were shuffled off toward the room where the Queen was to shake her hand, and others were sent to Prince Philip, and I was directed toward Her Majesty. But I have here with me Tom, who met the Queen at the same time Mary, and indeed Sean met the Queen. And I think I'm going to let Tom take over here. Can you take us through all of that, Tom?
Well, yes, we were invited to meet the Queen and Prince Philip at a reception they asked to be held for people in tourism. So we had little groups around the venue, and the Queen and Philip moved from one group to another. And in our group, we were waiting, and the Queen came, and the Queen spoke to us, and then Philip spoke to us. My abiding memory of Philip is something which marks him out for his whole life, I think, really. He, forthright, not very interested in generalities, probably not very keen on waffly answers, or probably on small talk. So perhaps it shouldn't have been a surprise that his question to us was, how much did we earn? Which is not the sort of question you instantly expect. And I think the response was, considerably less than you, sir. But it's a hallmark of Philip that throughout his life he has probed, challenged, questioned, sometimes getting him into trouble. And I think when I look back on Philip's contribution to this country, what strikes me is he's been there for my whole life, really. And although not being aware of it, he has had a tremendous influence on what has happened in this country. And indeed, his almost revolutionary scheme touched most of our schools when he introduced the Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme in 1956, I think it was. This idea that youngsters should do something other than that was academic, and that if they could succeed in one thing, then that success would set them up to succeed in other things. And the Duke of Edinburgh scheme is now in, I think, over 140 countries. And that's happened within my lifetime. I don't think it's surprising, really, with Prince Philip, that he didn't want to meet people endlessly saying, how are you, what a lovely day it is. And I have another memory of Philip, which is more extraordinary in a way, because on the same day that we met Prince Philip and the Queen at a reception just near Piccadilly Circus, we'd also be invited to a reception at Buckingham Palace. And so in the evening we went to Buckingham Palace, and with, I think, must have been several hundred others, I think, we were all in the staterooms. And I think the usual procedure is that the Queen and the royal family enter through what's known as a secret door at one end, and they do a circuit around the rooms. The royals fend for themselves, except the Queen, who has basically minders to clear space for as she goes through. And I think most people expect them to go right down the middle of the rooms, but I and a colleague of mine, we were standing by the wall, basically. So we weren't in this middle section. And to our astonishment, Philip came through, didn't continue down the middle, and literally walked straight up to where we were up by the wall. And he said to us, oh, so you managed to find your way here then, did you? He'd remembered us, and he remembered that we were tourist guides as well, and put the two together. And this was his 80th birthday. So it would have been 20 years ago had Prince Philip lived another 2 months or so. Now that's significant because we obviously wished him a happy birthday, and he wasn't really interested in being wished happy birthday. That was probably a trivial comment. But I recall that he was born on Corfu, 1921, and I had heard somewhere or other that Corfu had revised its calendar and had basically removed the very day on which Prince Philip was born in the change of calendar. So when we wished him a happy birthday, I for some reason thought there should be a follow-up to this, and so I said to Prince Philip, "But I actually understand you don't really have a birthday, do you, sir?" And he then told us the story of Corfu and that he'd been born there, calendar change, etc., etc., and he'd had this as a thing in his life, which was occasionally brought up. And afterwards I realised that actually that was quite an interesting interlude, because I also learnt something that Philip doesn't or didn't see any reason why people were interested in him particularly. I think he said, "I don't want to talk about myself, it's boring." But actually, we had succeeded in getting him to talk about himself a little bit, just in that 1 or 2 minutes before he moved off. And now, of course, somebody you think is forever there has, after the 73-year bond with the Queen, that bond is gone, and the country has lost one of its most important figures of modern times. So that is my memory of Prince Philip.
It's interesting, and it's moving, and it's so witty. I mean, when London Walks, well, three members of London Walks were invited to meet Her Majesty, that was at the offices of the British Tourism Office, I think it was, on, was it Lower Regent Street?
Yes, it was Lower Regent Street, please.
And then it was down to Buckingham Palace. So he remembered that you were a guide, and of course, everybody in the world knows where Buckingham Palace was.
Well, exactly.
Getting from Lower Regent Street to Buckingham Palace.
It isn't exactly too difficult.
Too difficult. So he's saying to you, "I see you managed to find your way down here."
Yes.
Down here is,
yes,
is pretty amusing. And it's impressive because he probably met, well, as you said, probably hundreds of people that day. Strangers, just for a second.
Yeah, it was certainly a lot of people that day.
Yeah, yeah. And
It didn't occur to me, as these things don't until afterwards, that he must have remembered us from the reception in the morning and had remembered what we did.
Yeah.
Which is pretty incredible, really.
Yeah.
And I agree with you, it was very witty on lots of and actually almost answerless in a way.
Yes.
Except say happy birthday, and then that led to the other thing.
Yeah, fantastic.
But it's he was described by the Queen as her strength, I think. And I think Philip gave a strength to the monarchy. He gave obviously strength to the Queen personally, but I suspect also strength in her role as head of state. And I think he also gave some of his strength to the country in the extraordinary things he's done in a very long and eventful life, of which the Duke of Edinburgh War Scheme is one of the most obvious.
Yeah. And yeah, an anchor point, really.
An anchor point.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary now that schools take this scheme for its full worth and, in a sense, take it for granted that it's going to be there.
Uh-huh.
But you have to realise that, you know, the UK, England in 1950s was a different world where this sort of thing had never, ever been tried in this way before. And and the organisations that were there, the Scouts, for instance, this could have been a direct challenge to them, but it wasn't couched in that way at all. You know, and then there's the idea that Philip was outraged that particularly inner city kids had no green spaces to play on. So he introduced the National Playing Field scheme. And certainly where I went to school, at my primary school, the pitch that was used was part of that playing field scheme. And it wouldn't have existed without Philip.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you move on to the conservation, the environment, etc., etc.
Was it one of the other guides mentioned, or did I read that he was the head of something like 700 organizations and charities?
Yes. And if we were to read through those, there would be some unlikely revelations, I suspect. And just imagine how many speeches he's, thousands of speeches, and I'm sure somebody has or will come up with the figure, and countless handshakes.
Absolutely, yeah. Countless. I mean,
you know, it's more than most people would even consider possible.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he was, I suppose you would say a difference maker, and as they always say, he will be remembered, and he will be missed.
Yes. I had an email from a friend in Canada earlier in which she started by saying there was an inevitability about this, but also a sadness. And she recalled that Philip had been to Canada and had commented on how unfit Canadians were. and that is again an example of Philip being forthright and, you know, just coming out with what he generally thought was...
Exactly.
Oh, dear. Yeah. But it's interesting that over the world, the tributes are flowing in.
Yes. Well, this is London Walks tribute. And I think Tom will close out the piece with your remarks here. I think we're going to begin with Sean's, and we'll end with your memories of him and your sage and wonderful comments about him, and indeed your anecdote about him remembering you and being impressed that you managed to find your way down to Buckingham Palace.
Yeah. And of course, the other side of that is, and I'm sure you've been fully aware of it, you're never going to forget it.
That's absolutely true. And I shall go on reminding you about it.
So, you know, so as well as building a conversation which is witty, he has built a conversation where the person is going to remember that conversation for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And that's no mean achievement, because I don't always remember what anybody says to me 2 hours ago.
Well, when I said to, we're now moving into the territory of a normal interview, but one of the things I said to Fiona last night was I gave her an assignment. I said that Richard Walker had told me a story that a client, a young lady from Montana who'd been on his walks had said to him, and he regards this as the highest possible compliment, or best compliment he's ever been paid. She said, "What I want is Richard Walker in my pocket narrating my life." And that gave me the idea that we're going to create a London Walks Commonplace book. And I want you to tell this story, to maybe write this little story up. That'll be your entry for this Commonplace. Even though this event took place 20 years ago, it's a lovely tale. So there you go.
Mind that you, can be pretty sure, you can be pretty sure that Prince Philip would not have wanted to be in any pocket narrating their lives.
Perfect.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking me, David. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.